Biological Jew by Eustace Mullins, Part 1. For 25 years, I have studied the problems of human failure, of falling short of the promise, and of the decay and collapse of great empires. This phenomenon has existed throughout the 5,000 years that man has been recording the history of his efforts. During the first 20 years that I devoted to this study, I amassed huge files of information about the various civilizations. I compared these facts in order to find common denominators which might lead to a solution. I also took into consideration such factors as man's environment, his nature, and the persistence of certain patterns in his behavior. This led me to an involved study of the animal kingdom and a compilation of those factors which it bore in common with the plant kingdom. About 5 years ago, I discovered the common denominator of man's civilizations. I had come to it directly through my studies in biology, for this common denominator is found throughout the plant and the animal kingdoms. Because it was a natural phenomenon, and such a ubiquitous one, an ordinary and accepted part of all levels of plant and animal life, no scholar had previously thought to examine this factor as a prime cause of the degeneration and the fall of empires. This factor was parasitism. In the great advances which medicine had made during the past century, one of its most impressive achievements had been the rapidly developing field of parasitology. It had been found that many of man's most serious ailments were caused by parasites. From these studies, it was only a matter of time before scholars would be able to deduce that a similar condition might occur among man's civilizations, and that it might also cause sickness and death. It was to be expected that in their autopsies of buried empires, scholars should conclude that this condition, parasitism, was a definitive factor in the fatal diseases which befell human civilizations. But no scholar advanced this conclusion. In the entire Library of Congress, no work can be found which deals with the social effects of parasitism on civilization. There are hundreds of works about the medical aspects of parasitism, but none about its equally serious socio-economic effects. Why is this? Why have not the thousands of scholars in this field cast in desperately for the slightest limb on which to build the flimsy thought which will serve as their doctoral thesis, been unable to see what is in front of them, the destructive effects of parasitic groups on civilization? Let us offer the simplest explanation, since that is the usually correct one. The parasitic group in the civilization has fixed its domination over the academic and scholarly world. It would not tolerate any academic study which threatened its continued domination. Is this a far-fetched conclusion? Then let us search for a better one, and after we have been unable to find one, let us examine several accepted factors. First, we know that parasitism exists in mankind. Second, the parasitic group is a compact, well-directed and inner-directed species. Third, the parasitic group, in order to maintain its parasitic position, must exercise some sort of control over its host, because no host willingly tolerates the presence of the parasite. One obvious form of control would be a control over what the host thinks about, reads, and sees as entertainment, education, and news. The studies of parasitism have progressed at a fantastic rate during the 20th century, and I can take no special credit for having formulated the social theory of the parasitic group in human civilization, because this theory has been staring us in the face for at least two generations past. Nevertheless, so obscured has been this phenomenon that it took me 5 years to develop this theory, and I am aware that even now I am only opening the door for a host of scholars who can employ this theory to shed much greater light upon human problems than I have been able to do in this comparatively brief time. Insofar as it has been possible, I have attempted to make this work as non-technical as possible, as much as the nature of the theory allowed, so that scholars in many other fields could employ it in their own work. The ramifications of this theory indicate that it can be immediately useful and profitable in the areas of sociology, government, and history, both for the professional scholar and for the layman.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
Most of us think of a parasite as something distasteful, whose role in life is to feed at the expense of someone else. As a result, the term, when applied to humans, is always one of disgust. In the animal and plant kingdoms, also, the parasite is universally disliked. The Oxford English Dictionary of 1933 defines the term thusly. 1. One who eats at the table or at the expense of another. Always an opprobrious application. 2. Biology. An animal or plant which lives in or upon another organism, technically called its host, and draws its nutrient directly from it. 3. Figuratively. A person whose part or action resembles that of an animal parasite. Thus we find that a parasite is one who is disliked, who feeds at the expense of another, and who lives in or upon another organism, which is called the host. We also find that the term can be applied to a person whose life follows the classic life pattern of the parasite. Now, in the study of mankind, we find that there is one group or classification of persons who appear persistently in the records of the great civilizations. They are always disliked, yet they remain in the midst of the people who dislike them, and if they are driven out, they insist upon returning, no matter at what cost, to themselves. We also find that they always manage to live at the expense of others. The Encyclopedia Britannica defines parasitism as follows. Quote, parasitism, a one-sided nutritive relationship between two organisms of different kinds, a relationship which is more or less injurious, yet not usually fatal to the host, a relationship, moreover, that relieves the parasite from most of the activity or struggle which is usually associated with procuring food, and thus tends to favour or induce some degree of simplification or degeneracy. Close quote. In the record of many civilizations, we find that the presence of the parasitic group is in many instances fatal to the host people, because it affects fundamental changes in the life pattern of the host people and diverts their primary energies to the feeding of the parasites. This alteration affects every aspect of the host people's existence and inevitably weakens them to the point where they are destroyed. Since the Encyclopedia Britannica refers above to a purely biological parasite condition in the animal and the plant kingdoms, it is true that the parasitic relationship can be injurious without being fatal over a period of time. Yet even in these instances, we find many examples of plants and animals being killed by parasites, a fact which apparently was not known to the learned scholar who authored the authoritative Encyclopedia Britannica article on this condition. We find, too, that the parasitic group is continually denounced by the more moral elements among the host people, because the parasitic group indulges in every known type of degeneracy. The reasons for this are obvious. As the Encyclopaedia Britannica article points out, a parasitic existence leads to degeneracy, since the parasite does not have to trouble himself with the active procurement of food. He has plenty of time and energy to devote himself to the vilest pursuits and to the debauching of members of the host people. The Encyclopaedia Britannica also paragraphs an important factor in the present study, the localization of the parasite within the host. The Britannica article points out that, quote, parasites are often localized to a particular site within the host, close quote. Since the parasite has reduced its life aims to one goal, that of remaining upon the host and feeding at its expense, it must choose a location where this is possible. The location must be one from which the host cannot readily dislodge it, and it must be one which allows the parasite to feed without exertion. As a result, the parasite usually chooses a place in or near the reproductive organs or the excretory organs of the host. Throughout history, the parasitic group has chosen to localize itself near the reproductive or the excretory organs of the host. In most cases, this has meant settling in the great cities of the host people, although in nations which were primarily agricultural, the parasitic group managed to disperse itself among the villages. Webster's Third International Dictionary defines the parasite as an organism living in or on another living organism, obtaining from it part or all of its organic nutriment, and commonly exhibiting some degree of structural modification. This is an important characteristic of the parasitic group in the history of mankind. It has exhibited an amazing ability to change or to modify itself in order to achieve its parasitical goal. It has developed extremely refined techniques for remaining upon the host and sophisticated methods of continuing to feed at the host's expense. It has adopted many guises, and it has shown a tremendous amount of adaptability for appearing in various forms in order to remain in place. To continue with Webster's Third International Dictionary, parasite, something that resembles a biological parasite in dependence upon something else for existence, without making a useful or adequate return. Illus, the great city, is a parasite on the country. Francois Bondy. Close quote. This is the last important key to the solution of our problem, the decay of human civilization. The parasite depends on something else for existence, without making a useful or an adequate return. Throughout our study of history, we find that the parasitic group never makes any return or shows any gratitude for being allowed to feed upon the host. The parasite's motto is always take. Should we be surprised, then, to find that this motto actually appears in the written literature of a known parasitic group? We now ask the listener, what group appears and reappears in the history of one civilization after another? What group has always been actively disliked by its host peoples? What group has played an often decisive role in the decay and collapse of one civilization after another? What group indulges in every type of degeneracy? What group always localizes to certain positions among the host peoples? And what group refuses to fulfill a constructive role in any civilization, but instead remains true to its motto of always take, while refusing to make a useful or an adequate return? This group, as the listener may have already surmised from their own studies, is known throughout history as the Jews. Prior to the present study, human individuals or groups living at the expense of others were often called parasites, but this term was used purely in a sociological sense, without any biological point of reference. Plantation owners were said to be parasites because they lived at the expense of their slaves. Aristocrats were said to be parasites because they lived at the expense of the masses. Armies were said to be parasites because they lived at the expense of the workers. But in every case, the supposed parasites were performing certain duties and fulfilling certain responsibilities within the society. Thus, we find that, in the purely sociological sense, it is possible to name many groups as parasitical, such as children and those who are too old to work. They are certainly feeding at the expense of others, performing no useful work and making no adequate return. But these groups either have done useful work in the past, or they are expected to do so in the future. Thus, they do not fall within the accepted framework of the biological definition of a parasite. Throughout this work, we will find that the biological references hold true to an amazing degree in establishing the history and the presence of a parasitical group, and that in every instance the records of the Jews prove that they are fulfilling the role of biological parasites. In nature, we find that the parasite often attempts to disguise its parasitical life cycle and to appear to be like ordinary plants and animals. Thus, a description of the biological plant Crameria in the Conditions of Parasitism in Plants by D.T. McDougall and W.A. Cannon, quote, "The western United States desert bush, Crameria, is parasitic on a number of woody hosts. Crameria does not at first glance seem to be a parasite, for it does not grow directly upon its host, but its roots reach out beneath the ground and tap the roots of its host, drawing nutriment therefrom. Its favourite host is Corvillia tridentata, although it is also parasitic on the acacia and a number of other plants. Its condition of parasitism was discovered after scientists were puzzled that it had no deep-going taproot. It is a greyish shrub, bearing fruit and leaves at certain seasons of the year." Close quote. The parasite in nature often finds it convenient to disguise itself and its aims and to convince others that it is something else in order to carry out its parasitic mission. Also, the parasite is not a species, but a form of life, which preys upon many other different species. In this regard, the Jew as a biological species is not so much a race as it is a type which preys upon all other races. As Geoffrey Lepage points out in his definitive work, Parasitic Animals, quote, "A parasitic animal is not a particular species of animal, but an animal which has adopted a certain way of living." Close quote. In regard to Crameria's failure to develop a deep taproot, which is not necessary for its parasitic existence, we may note that the Jew never develops deep roots in any culture of a host people, but confines himself to the most superficial and the most quickly profitable aspects of its existence. Therefore, a Jew is not so much a particular species in the civilized world as he is a type which has adopted a certain form of parasitic life and adapted himself to exist upon a host which can provide his food. Lepage continues, quote, "Unlike many other biological terms, the word parasite and its adjective parasitic have been taken into the everyday language of men and women, and have, in the course of common usage, acquired emotional and moral connotations with which science, and therefore biology, has nothing whatsoever to do with. The biologist's outlook is scientific, and because it is so, he does everything in his power to remove from his studies all human likes and dislikes and all human moral judgments. He neither despises nor admires, likes or dislikes, condemns or approves the parasitic organism. He studies it, its way of living, as dispassionately as he can, seeing parasites as one of the various ways of living practiced by different kinds of animals. Close quote. We agree wholeheartedly with Professor Lepage's admonition to be completely scientific and to follow the resolve not to be swayed by emotional judgments. It was precisely by this method of dispassionate study that this writer arrived at his definition of the biological Jew. Only by studying him unemotionally as a biological phenomenon can we hope to learn how to combat the maleficent influence which the parasitic body inevitably exerts upon the more advanced human civilizations. Lepage points out that we find in general two kinds of animal associations: those who belong to one species, such as herds, colonies of coral, communities of bees, etc., and two, associations of different species in the same area. To this second category, parasitism belongs, for we find groups with roots in an area entertaining parasites who have no roots in that area. One of the more interesting facets of parasitism is that the parasite lives an existence which often goes beyond the customary laws of nature and of man. The parasite seems not to be bound by limiting factors of climate, geography, and other elements which play a commanding role in the lives of most groups. Thus, we find that a parasite can survive in an area in which it has no roots, while its host does have roots in the area and has established its existence there over a period of time. Lepage also remarks that parasitism is different from commensalism, a frequently encountered biological term which means eating at the same table. He cites as examples of commensalisms the oxpecker birds, which perch upon the backs of rhinoceros, elephants, and other large animals on the African plains. These birds not only eat ticks, lice, and other parasites which infest the animals, but they also warn the animals of approaching danger. In England, we find that starlings and sheep have a similar commensal arrangement. We also have the phenomenon of symbiosis, a biological term meaning living together. This is a somewhat more intimate living arrangement than commensalism, because we find in symbiosis a physiological dependence of each partner upon the other. Each one supplies some food to the other, without which life would be more difficult or even impossible, and neither lives an independent life. Parasitism, however, is defined by Lepage as similar to commensalism and symbiosis in that the association is based upon the need for an adequate food supply. He states that parasitism is an association between one partner, called the parasite, which obtains by a number of different methods its food from the body of the other partner, which is called the host of the parasite. But, asks Lepage, does the other partner, the host, benefit? He answers that it never does. The host is always injured by the parasite. Thus, parasitism differs from commensalism and symbiosis in two particulars. First, not both, but only one of the partners, the parasite, gains a food supply. And second, not both, but only one of the partners benefits, while the host always suffers some injury. Lepage conjectures that the first parasite may have been a non-parasitic organism which penetrated, by some route, the body of another kind of animal and found some food there, such as blood, which was rich in nutrition and easily digestible, and that in the course of evolution, the descendants of this first parasite liked this way of life and maintained such an association with some other animal. Eventually, these types became wholly dependent upon parasitism as a way of obtaining food and could not survive without following it. Thus, it became an obligatory parasite, completely dependent physiologically upon its host. As Lepage points out, the host does not tolerate passively this association with the parasite, but reacts to the injury which it is suffering. He says, quote, "The struggle between host and parasite went on according to the laws of evolution, and this battle is constantly being waged today. Parasitism is quite different from the relationship of prey and predator, in which one body gets its nourishment by killing and absorbing the body of another. Here, the predator is always larger and stronger than its prey, while the parasite is always smaller and weaker than its host." Close quote. Thus we find that here, once more, the parasite violates a fundamental law of nature. It is a law of nature that the stronger survives at the expense of the weaker, the survival of the fittest, as the weaker is eaten to provide nourishment for the strong. In the phenomenon of the parasite, however, we find that the weaker survives at the expense of the stronger. The least fitted to survive becomes the victor, and the stronger is vanquished. This, too, is a fundamental aspect of the life cycle of the biological Jew. Throughout history, he has always been smaller and weaker than his Gentile host, yet he has often managed to subdue him. The puny weakling, as celebrated by the Jewish comedian Charlie Chaplin, always manages to outwit and to defeat his larger and stronger Gentile opponent. We find that this celebration is a fundamental approach in all Jewish humor, literature, and art. The small David is shown defeating the larger Goliath. The cunning Mordecai is shown defeating the stronger Gentile official, Haman. David, of course, is the small parasite, and Goliath is the large host who is struck down from afar before he has a chance to use his superior strength against the weakling challenger.